This is a podcast from ABC Overnights.
My next guest is an award-winning Irish novelist whose books have sold more than 35 million copies. Books, by the way, which have been translated into 36 languages. And her witty, fearless prose has changed lives the world over. Marianne Keys, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, welcome to Australia. How was the flight?
The flight was grand because I came the quickest way possible. I came in via Perth, which knocks a good, 6 or 7 hours off the worst of it. So one stop in Dubai, week here in Western Australia, and then smaller flights as I make my way eastwards.
Right. So you get on a kind of airlock system where you partition it so you don't do it all in one go. Because otherwise it's 27 hours straight from Ireland, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, if I was coming to Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane.
Nightmare. Absolute nightmare. Very smart. As an author, by the way, what do you do on a long flight? Do you movies, TV, or are you getting work done? Are you one of those?
I wish. I just met somebody today who says, oh, I'm on planes a lot, like I always use it to write. And I was just looking at her thinking, what are you? What kind of strange, weird creature are you? No, the thing that I like to do most in life is to eat. And the second thing I like to do most in life is to sleep. So some combination of the two of them, if it's at all possible. I read. I don't know. I don't like watching movies on my own. I know that you can watch it with the person beside you. I like to have company. I'm obviously incredibly codependent. So eating, sleeping, reading.
Okay, so you're basically a cat in the sky at that point.
That's a nice way of putting it. Thank you.
No problem. I've noticed that when I'm flying, any kind of narrative that I imbibe makes me 20 times more emotional. A film in the sky will make you cry at the drop of a hat. Can you pivot your books to really target people who are emotionally vulnerable on a flight? Have you ever seen someone reading one of your books and just sobbing uncontrollably and gone over to console them, or has that never happened before?
It's never happened. And now I feel two things. I feel like I've missed out, and I'm also taking it as a challenge. I am now going to patrol the aisles and see what people are reading. And if it is something by me,
yeah,
I'm going to hang around and just see if, or they might find something extremely funny. That would be nice, to have uncontrollable mirth. We could all do with a bit of that.
Damn straight. Full disclosure, Marianne, we've been talking about personal heroes a little bit on the show, and I wanted to talk about yours. Who were the characters in literature or in cinema or in theatre that woke up that part of your brain when you were young, that shaped you, because they became your personal heroes?
My God, that's really, really, really hard. I don't really believe in heroes because I think they're only human. I kind of think heroes, it's a dangerous road to go down. Who do I like? I don't think I like many people. I liked Madonna in Desperately Seeking Susan, but that's not the kind of thing you're looking for.
This is interesting. I want to get your definition of hero, because for me, a hero is somebody who makes you want to be better. Now, that doesn't necessarily require a cape. That can be just a small act of heroism is what I'm looking for.
Okay, well, I absolutely loved the way she didn't care. In Desperately Seeking Susan, she's basically trying to steal a pair of boots and she's trying them on in the shop and the man is allowing her to walk on a small piece of ground that's the size of a doormat, and she keeps pushing at the boundaries. She just kind of does it to annoy him and also to try and steal the boots. And I thought, I wish I was like her. I wish I had her courage. Or your woman out of Gone with the Wind. What's her name?
Oh, God. Oh,
Scarlett O'Hara. Scarlett O'Hara. I mean, she was magnificent. She was the ultimate survivor. And, she went after what she wanted. And she didn't care that all the other women hated her. She wanted that spanner, red button. No, it wasn't. It was whatever his name was. She wanted the milk toast man, who, like anyone with any sense, would be wanting the Clark Gable fella. So she had bad taste in men, but she had a otherwise excellent taste in everything. And, just did what she needed to survive. Yeah, I liked her. She was another one. See, I liked these people who were fearless, because I was just very, very fearful, because that was the way, they liked us in Catholic Ireland. And any woman with her, a girl with any kind of a little bit of courage, a little bit of self-esteem. No. Take her out, take her away, and we must send her to the re-education camp, where all her self-esteem is taken from her, and she knows that she is, of course, utterly, utterly worthless. And then she can be, released back into the general populace. This is no good.
No, this is great because I actually, what I love about your characters is they are willing to make mistakes and look foolish because that's a way of kind of asserting dominance. And I'm not sure whether you would define that as heroic, but readers do view your assembly of leads as personal heroes. And I'm curious as to whether, by the metric we've just kind of stumbled our way through, you view them as heroic.
I mean, I suppose I view them as like unavoidably human. I mean, there's such the thing that interests me about people and what I like to write about is, the way we like to present the very best of ourselves to the world. We are our shiniest, we are, our most perfect, we are, our narratives are happy ones. Nothing terrible has ever really happened to us or will ever happen to us. But behind that shiny shell, there's so much shame and there's so much worry and there's hope and there's fervent love. And none of that really gets a chance to be expressed. So that's I like to write about that space where the feelings, where the true feelings live, and the way they sometimes leak through the cracks and what they do. And I suppose it's by like whatever emotions kind of make their way out into the world is how human beings connect. So that's kind of a very esoteric answer, but that is kind of what. It's the fact that we're all acting all the time, and the few times that we stop, that's when we're authentic, and that's when the important connection happens. That's what I think, anyway.
No, I completely agree. And I know we were talking about heroes in a sort of very highfalutin way, but what I like about Batman isn't the heroics, it's the trauma and it's the grief that drives him. And it's when Alfred goes, "Can you please eat something?" I mean, how much of the baggage and the wounds of your characters do you think contributes to their appeal?
Oh, very much. I mean, the broken bits are as important as the powerful bits because we're all very kind of comfortable with our own broken bits. Are not com comfortable. We're very familiar with them, and most of the time I spend my time wishing I was different this way and I was different that way. And I'm less knowledgeable about my heroic parts. And when you see that your heroes also have flaws, you think, well, if they have flaws and they're heroes and I have flaws, then I must also have heroic bits. So it is, it's that feeling of I am not as far away from being a hero as I thought I was.
That's a very good answer. I think we need to get you a cape. On the I mean, you have been very open about your struggles in the past, and I'm curious as to what role, because a lot of people use writing to kind of help other people, but I've found that sometimes creating things can help the person who is creating it. How much has writing helped you?
I mean, okay, I'd give you two different examples. I mean, I have lived a kind of a lively life with regard to poor mental health, and I, from a very early age, had trouble with alcohol, and by the age of 30, I ended up in rehab for alcoholism, and I had just started writing before I went in. So 2 books after I came out, my third novel, I wrote about a young woman who goes into rehab for drug addiction. And it wasn't like writing it wasn't in any way cathartic, like it wasn't healing in any way. I was far enough away from it at that stage, 3 years on, to be able to write a kind of a cold-eyed, dispassionate view of it. Like it didn't bring up any feelings in me. It didn't make me very sad. I was interested, I suppose, in the whole process of denial and then finding out. So that wasn't in any way cathartic. And then there was another book where like a couple were trying to get pregnant and couldn't. And I wanted to have children and I couldn't have them. That wasn't cathartic either. But there was one book, a good way in, called The Mystery of Mercy Close. I went through a really terrible bout of depression about 15 years ago. And like it was nothing like, I don't know, depression was always presented to me as kind of a nice sad thing that you sat and looked at windows like with raindrops trickling down and you just kind of felt a bit sad. And I didn't feel like that at all. I felt really scared all the time and like I was living on another planet. I had, it was a very, very a time of terrible aloneness. So I wrote a book about a woman, a private detective, who was going through the kind of depression that I was going through. And I was writing it to kind of say to the people around me, this is how I feel. This is what it feels like to me. Don't give me your version of depression because this is mine. And they were all like, go on out for like a good walk in the forest. Get out in the fresh air and get the endorphins and the leaves and you know the I didn't want that, and I didn't want to go swimming, and I didn't want to take up weaving, you know. And there were so many things they told me to do, and I didn't want to do any of them because I knew they wouldn't work. And I did find various things that kind of took the edge off it for me, but like nobody can give you their cure to your illness was kind of the point of that book. And that was the one book that I used as I wouldn't say, well, it helped me. Yes, it helped me. Like it's a novel, and I hope that people enjoy it. But it was written very much for myself to just kind of say, this is what it's like. You know, depression is not the way you always think it is.
It's not an aesthetic, it's an actual thing that gets into your bones. And it's fascinating reading how you sort of take very dark, dark subject matter and make it so funny. I mean, your comedic lens is just it's startlingly bright. It's wonderful. I wanted to ask you how important is comedy to you, and do you have to sometimes just laugh at a thing to disempower the weight that it has?
Oh, you're lovely. I mean, definitely, like it's kind of a cliche, but like Irish people do use laughter as a way of dealing with bad stuff. I mean it's definitely a survival mechanism. And in the home that I was brought up in, like it was kind of the law. Like you never got any sympathy until you turned your tragedy into a kind of an entertaining story. You know, like you could have come in the door and like you're blind in one eye because I don't know, brick fell on your head, and my mother wouldn't give me any sympathy until I went back out the door and then came in with a funny story of how the brick landed and acted out doing the angle and everything. And once I had done that, then I had her attention. I had won her attention and her care by giving her a story. I mean, and that was just the way it was, that you know, a disaster plus 20 minutes is an entertaining anecdote. And I mean, I know it's a cliche. I mean, and it kind of drives me mad because it is really true. And like I always surrounded myself with people who were, you know, articulate and funny. And even like I left Ireland in my 20s and I lived in London, but I always lived with other Irish people because they were just very, very funny. And I didn't even know that I valued funny stories, but I really it was definitely something that would mattered to me, and that like we were kind of practicing on each other. None of us knew that one of us was going to be a writer, but day to day, it mattered to all of us to be entertaining.
ABC Overnight's here with me, Paul Verhoeven, and I'm currently chatting with best-selling author Marion Keyes. Marion, you mentioned family before, so in a nutshell, just to pivot, who are the Walsh sisters to you?
When I wrote my first book, Watermelon, it was about a woman called Claire Walsh, and she's the eldest of five siblings. And completely coincidentally, I also was the eldest of five siblings. You know, I obviously have no imagination whatsoever. And so I created these five sisters. Now, I have two sisters and two brothers, and the Walsh characters are not based on my siblings, but the whole dynamic of like a very noisy, you know, highly emotional, highly opinionated, you know, competitive family. The whole dynamic of my real family was given to the Walshes. For me, it was more fun that they were all women because that, you know, there was just more opportunities for like scraps over like, you know, shoes and men. And the mother in Miss Mammy Walsh is not dissimilar to Mammy Keyes, who is this terrifyingly, she's this tiny little terrifying matriarch. She's, you know, she's about the size of my hand. And she hasn't had a well day in her life, but she wields enormous power. We're all terrified of her. And over the years, the five sisters have been given a novel of their own. And in recent years, and like they're all standalone, you don't have to have read any of the others. And in recent years, I've written a couple of sequels. But a TV series has just wrapped, as they say. I know you have a thing going, has just been greenlit, so we are talking the language of filming and stuff, has just wrapped on a six episode series called The Walsh Sisters. And it's about the five sisters, the mum and the dad. Two of the sisters are in the ascendant, Rachel and Anna. And it is going to be on show, whatever it is. What do we say? You can watch it
It'll be
in
streaming.
Australia.
It'll
Streaming,
be.
stream. Okay, thank you. Streaming. I don't know the words anymore. Yes, it will be streaming on Stan. At some time, it comes out in the UK and Ireland in November. So hopefully, it'll be around the same time. It's gone off to be edited now, and then they do all these thrilling things, like put the music for it. It's and the whole experience has just been delicious, because often you hear a writer say, you know, it's nothing like my book, and I don't like anything, and I never want to take my name off the credits. And I don't feel like that at all. I love every bit of it, and I've met the cast, and I love them all, and the whole thing has been just completely, completely joyous.
That's fantastic. Also, I mean, look, my favorite mistake is your 16th novel. You've been writing the Walsh sisters since Watermelon back in the mid-90s, and you've revisited them over and over. That's a lot of time to become attached to what I would call specific notions of what they look and act and sound like. How was it seeing someone's very specific take?
Honest to God, Paul, it was amazing.
Oh.
I really can't tell you. It was like they saw inside my head. Like the eldest sister, Claire, she's kind of the glammy, slightly kind of a bit too kind of glitzy, you know. And the day I saw her, like she like loads of like blonde highlights in her hair, and she had gold rimmed sunglasses, and she was strutting along in these silver shoes, and she her whole body language was just completely Claire. And then there's Helen. She's the odd one, the one who never really kind of, you know, she misses social cues the whole time. And there was something about her jeans, like they were slightly too short, in a kind of a there's something not right with that girl kind of a way. And like she was wearing a bomber jacket, and her hands were like little bunched into little fists, and they were thrust into the pockets, and she just radiated disdain for the world. It was ridiculous. The detail, the body language, the clothing, the way they had their nails done, you know, even before they opened their mouths, I could have told you which was which. I mean, they had great people working on hair and wardrobe, and the woman Stephanie Pricer, who adapted the books, is kind of the showrunner. Looks so like she was all over everything, and she's very much a details person. She's a genius. But I went with my husband that day, and like we've lived with these characters for 30 years, and we both felt really emotional. It was the most beautiful feeling ever. Because like I said, we wanted children, we didn't have them, and I'm not saying these are our children, but there was something about these people are wearing those clothes and walking around and saying those lines because of us. It felt really, really lovely.
But I talk to friends of mine who are parents, and they're like, "Yeah, you know, our kids get to kind of carry our stories and our lineage forward." And I'm going, "But if you write a story with characters in it that affect people, how are you not doing the same thing magnified by 100? How have you? These kind of are your kids."
Yeah, I mean, they are and they aren't. I mean, you know, because they're not. But it felt like a huge honor that things that were in my head now have a different life in the world. And even strange things, the fact that like there were all these people there walking around with clipboards, so many people, so many clipboards, and they were all there. They all had a job,
You gave
a
them jobs
clipboard.
with clipboards.
With a clipboard, yes, and all the clipboards had jobs. Do you know? Like it felt strange and lovely.
That's such a lovely response, because you just get so many people who are jaded about this stuff, and you're going, look, it is weird though. You made that happen. That all happened because of you. Those people are there because of something you did back in 1995. Was it 95?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yes.
Oh my God.
That's... You know, and it's 26 years since anything was made of any of my books. And I have to say, it was worth waiting for. This particular cast, the crew, the director, the writer, everything was worth waiting for. I do not subscribe to this everything happens for a reason business. I really don't. It annoys me terribly. I just think it's toxic positivity. But in this particular case, I do feel I am happy that it took as long as it did for it to be in this version. You know, I'm very grateful for it.
Right. So it's less that everything happens for a reason and more looking at a thing that's happened that is improbable and wonderful and going, maybe that happened for a reason.
Yes, that's a beautiful way of putting it. A very wise young man.
Okay. I was going to ask you all kinds of highfalutin questions about what your favorite mistake is and about trauma and blah, blah, blah. But actually, I read something about half an hour before this chat, Marion. My favorite lolly is Percy Pig. And I read that you're a Percy pursuer. Can we talk about this just for a second, please?
Absolutely a Percy pursuer, did you say?
Yeah, I've just coined that. I hope that's okay.
Beautiful. No, this is beautiful. We have to set up an online community. I have so much. I have a huge Percy Pig bear, like a bear, but it's a pig.
Yeah.
Like it's a huge cushion. I have one of those cool bags that you bring, you know, if you're going to the beach, not an esky, but like a soft one to keep things cold. I have a Percy Pig apron. I have had a Percy Pig Easter egg. You can get Percy Pig biscuits now. Have you access to any of these things? I'll try and send them to you if you haven't.
I don't. It's very, look, I'll be honest. The Percy Pig ecosystem here is pretty thin on the ground. I ran into them by mistake and now I'm obsessed. Wouldn't it be amazing?
They're like crack.
They're amazing.
Yeah, they're so addictive.
It's the texture that gets me, right?
Yes. It's that foaminess. They're just the right amount of squish, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah,
if they're perfect.
Like,
perfection.
Marion, if I ever bit into a real pig and it didn't have that texture, I'd be very disappointed. You know?
Of course you would.
Yeah.
Of course you would.
Yeah.
Now, can I ask you? Do you know about the different ones? Like, there's the Percy Pig and the globe trotting pigs. Do you know about these?
No. What?
Oh no, this is awful. Okay, I'm going to just check one thing now. Okay, point to where the no. Okay, have you had a Molly Moo?
No. Hang on. Maybe. I don't want to have to Google it. Am I starting to think, because you're coming to Melbourne, do we need to have some sort of like little pig pen meetup? Hang on, let me just see. What's a... Hang on,
there must be something.
All right, I'll find something out. Here we go. Yeah, let's see. No, I haven't.
You've never had a Molly Moo?
No.
Oh my God. Oh, the Molly Moo have cola flavors, but then there's a goat and a sheep and they all have different flavors. Then there's a thing called a penny pig, which is a kind of an apricot flavor. And so there was a whole story about Molly Moo stealing Penny Pig away from Percy Pig. Oh my God, there's a whole universe waiting for you to discover.
We need to find some way to contact the manufacturers and get some
sort
of Walsh.
It's Marks and Spencer's. It's Marks and Spencer's.
I want Marks and Spencer's to do a special Walsh Sisters edition where we get each of the sisters made up. Sort of.
Wouldn't that be amazing? But even just to get some Globetrotters to you, you know, that's the least we can do.
I mean, like
the original, and also just a couple of other things. You know that they do vegan versions now.
Yeah, I do know that. Yes.
Yeah, and that the vegan ones are just as nice.
Mm-hmm.
They are identically as nice. And they also do ones that are they're a third less sugar. You know, if that is one of your worries. It just like if you're like me and you can't have one of anything, you know, I have one of something and then I need to have 4,000 more.
Yes.
The 30% off makes a big difference when we're dealing with those kind of quantities.
Damn straight. I agree. I completely agree. I go through entire bags. It's like I blink and it's gone.
It's gone.
I can't believe that I have you here to talk about the writer's circuit and about the soft cover version of the book and all this other stuff. And we've just gone straight into a weird...
The important stuff. We've got straight to the truly important stuff.
If you don't finish a show during your live tour and have someone pelt you with these things, I don't think they've been listening properly, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, I insist upon it.
Please do. Yeah, just wear some sort of protective clothing. Unfortunately, there's so much more we could talk about. But I guess what I want to say is that you're going to be doing a whole bunch of talks live on stage. How important is it to you to meet and interface with the people who actually read your books?
The loveliest part of my job. Mm. I can't tell you how much it means to me because, at this stage, I'm lucky enough to do sort of big venues, like with hundreds of people. But my desire and the feeling always is that it's extremely intimate. You know, I want everyone to feel, and it works. Somehow it works. I think we're all on the same wavelength. And I kind of know at this stage, you know, there's a certain number of questions that people want to talk to me about. And I always make sure that they're kind of included. It is hugely enjoyable. And it becomes very informal, and I don't know, people leave having made friends. Well, I leave like feeling like I've made friends, and I just want everyone to have a good time. Like, I'm not going to sit up there like stroking my menopausal goatee and, you know, talk about my process, you know, because I don't think that many people are they don't care. They want to talk about important things, like, as you said, Percy Pigs,
yeah,
you know, or shoes or whatever. You know, it's my chance to get to know my readers, and I really hope that my readers get to know me. I enjoy it enormously. It's the best part by miles. You know, if I could just do it and never write books, I probably would, but then I would have nothing to talk about after a while, so I'd have to write books.
Yeah, okay, so it's sort of a package deal. But look, I mean, I can't wait to come see you do your thing on stage, and I just want to say sincerely, thank you so much for being here and talking. It's been delightful.
It has been delightful, Paul. Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. That was the inimitable Marion Keyes, who, along with being a Percy Pig enthusiast and a best-selling author and a singular wit, is also touring Australia through May, and you can get ticket info from penguin.com.au, and a new Melbourne event's been added. Her 16th novel, My Favourite Mistake, is now available in paperback.